President Bush is in Australia today for a state visit and talks aimed at resolving Australia's complaints about U.S. farm subsidies. The president will meet with Paul Keating, who recently assumed the post of prime minister after former Premier Bob Hawke was forced out because of problems with the economy. Australia, like the United States, is in the midst of recession and high unemployment. The Ukrainian cabinet has decided to begin lifting price controls on Thursday. The government says that with some important exceptions, prices on goods and services would be governed by the law of supply and demand. The measure follows a similar move in Russia that caused controversy at the summit of the Commonwealth of Independent States in Minsk. The BBC's Sally Eckroyd reports from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
A decision by the Ukrainian cabinet announced by Ukrainian radio marks a big shift in position for the government here. Only this week, President Kravchuk was saying that Ukraine didn't have enough rubles to cope with the rise in prices and the rise in salaries that, he maintained, would have to go with it. But 8 hours of hard bargaining at Minsk on Monday may have helped persuade him. That and the prospect of Russians pouring over the border into Ukraine to take advantage of cheaper goods. The decision to free prices just when Ukraine seemed poised to mount border controls to stop the Russians raiding its market indicates that reformers advising the cabinet may have persuaded it to take the less painful path. But as in Russia, the government in Ukraine says that even under liberalization, the prices of some basic goods will treble and then remain fixed.
Sally Eckroyd reporting for the BBC. United Nations Special Envoy Cyrus Vance has held talks in Belgrade with Serbian political and military leaders in the first phase of his fifth Yugoslav peace mission. Pierre Vickery reports that Vance expressed his dismay that the level of fighting in Croatia appeared to have worsened since his last visit.
Cyrus Vance began his fifth peace mission by holding talks in Belgrade with the Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic, and the Yugoslav defense minister, General Kadijevic. The UN envoy discussed the preconditions for the deployment of an international peacekeeping force if the war in Croatia comes to an end. Cyrus Vance also presented his latest proposals for a restructured Yugoslav state, under which Serbia and Montenegro would form a centralized inner federation, Bosnia and Macedonia a loose confederation, and Slovenia and Croatia would be linked in a Commonwealth arrangement similar to the former Soviet republics. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Stock prices set another record today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained almost 5 points to close at 3,168.8. This is NPR News. Iraq said today that it will deport two American businessmen who've been jailed in Baghdad on charges of illegally entering the country from Kuwait. The State Department said today that it's not clear when the two men will be able to leave Iraq. The two men haven't been identified because of U.S. government privacy regulations. They were arrested on December 6th after they allegedly strayed over the border from Kuwait. The men have been visited by officials from the Polish consulate in Baghdad, which represents U.S. interests in Iraq. Today, the Peace Corps announced that it hopes to send 500 volunteers to the republics of the former Soviet Union in the next 2 years. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
According to Elaine Chow, the new director of the Peace Corps, Ukraine and Armenia have already requested Peace Corps volunteers, and other former Soviet republics are expected to follow suit. For these programs, the Peace Corps is looking for people with 5 years of business experience to help set up small enterprises. Also needed are English teachers and experts in environmental cleanup. Peace Corps will provide language training for volunteers, and it will offer a modest allowance, about $100 a month, for those who serve. Critics say this mission in the former Soviet Union will force the Peace Corps to cut back its activities in the poorest nations of the world. Asked whether that might happen, Elaine Chow said, "Absolutely not." She said the Peace Corps will seek additional funding for the new programs and added, "There is support in Congress for this." This is Ted Clark in Washington.
South and North Korea have agreed on the basic principles of a treaty that would keep their peninsula free from nuclear weapons, but the details of how it will be enforced haven't been settled. The two nations have already agreed on a process that could reunite them, but the issue of nuclear arms has threatened to undo it. Intelligence experts have said that North Korea is working on a nuclear bomb and could have the ability to build a crude one in the next few years. The U.S. has postponed its withdrawals of troops until the nuclear issue is resolved. This is NPR. Since General Motors recently announced it plans to close 21 plants and lay off 74,000 workers, many states and cities have organized to try to make sure their plants aren't on the shutdown list. Today, Ohio mapped out its plan to save a truck assembly plant in suburban Dayton. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
At stake in Ohio, 3,200 hourly factory jobs, plus thousands more in spin-off jobs. That's why Governor George Voinovich met today with two dozen union leaders, legislators, and the GM plant manager. Voinovich did not call for any extraordinary financial incentives to GM. Instead, he said many incentives are already available. Job training grants, highway construction, tax abatements, low-interest loans. The governor said the Ohio plant's constant winning of awards for quality might actually be a bigger selling point than incentives.
That long history of cooperation between this facility and the community and this facility and their labor management relationships, that's money in the bank.
Voinovich plans to meet soon with GM officials in Detroit to make his sales pitch. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The Commerce Department reported today that sales of new homes remained unchanged in November, despite big differences from region to region across the country. There was a big drop in demand for new single-family houses in the Northeast, but that was balanced by strong sales in the South and West. Sales of new homes remained the same as in October, when demand had gone up by 3.8%. Economists had worried that diminishing consumer confidence would stop any recovery in home sales. The housing industry is considered to be a key factor in any recovery, and economists have raised the hope that low prices and low mortgage interest rates will get home sales moving again. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR newscasts is provided by Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine, helping Americans reach their financial goals. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Like the war in the Gulf and the disintegration of the Soviet Union, the decline of the U.S. economy was a major event of this past year. Here at home, the recession cost nearly 2 million Americans their jobs, and a much-rumored recovery failed to materialize. Wall Street, however, is singing a different tune. Since last week, the stock market has set 4 new records. In fact, by the end of trading today, the market had recorded its best December since 1924. We asked NPR's Eric Weiner to explain the apparent contradiction. Here's his report.
By now, the story behind the stock market's Christmas week rally is familiar. It began on December 20th when the Federal Reserve cut the discount rate, the rate at which it lends money to banks, by a full percentage point. The move brought the rate to its lowest level in 27 years, and lower interest rates mean that other investments, such as savings accounts or CDs, are less attractive. So many people have been transferring their money out of those investments and into the stock market. But some economists don't believe that that shift alone explains the market's record performance. Jeremy Siegel, an economist with the Wharton School in Philadelphia, says that investors in the stock market are onto something.
This rally, I think, is the evidence that investors in the market think that a recovery by next year is a sure bet now.
Siegel says that, in fact, it is the lower interest rates that have prompted the rally, but not for the reasons most people think. Lower rates mean that firms save money on their own interest costs and are therefore more likely to rack up profits in the coming months. Another explanation for the apparent contradiction between the stock market's performance and that of the economy in general, says Siegel, is that all the disappointing economic reports we're hearing are actually old news. For instance, this morning the Commerce Department reported that its index of leading economic indicators was down slightly. The index is supposed to predict the state of the economy 6 to 9 months from now. But it makes those forecasts based on figures gathered in November, a month before the Federal Reserve cut the discount rate.
Most of investors are sort of throwing away that data and saying, you know, that was the old psychology, but they believe there is going to be a new psychology dawning with this move by the Fed.
Not all economists, however, are convinced that Wall Street is as savvy as it might appear.
Already the stock market has failed to deliver the recovery in the fashion that it typically does, and I think that's very important.
Lacey Hunt is chief economist for the Hong Kong Bank Group. He says that lately the stock market has gone off into its own orbit and tells us nothing about the economy and its chances for a strong recovery.
In the past, when the stock market turned up, the recovery was on average just 4 months away. We've now been in an upturn in the stock market for 14 months.
Hunt says there are simply too many signs that contradict the stock market's optimistic view. Consumer confidence, he says, remains flat. Bankruptcy filings have reached record highs, and the nation's banks are still in trouble. Both blue-collar and, to an unprecedented degree, white-collar jobs have been cut.
I'm glad that we have the gain in the stock market, but the stock market is virtually the only thing, aside from healthcare, that is doing well.
One analyst attributed the market's recent rally to a kind of psychological momentum. Nothing means anything to the market, he says, except that the market is going up right now. All the statistics, he adds, are irrelevant. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
President Bush arrived today in Australia, the first stop on his tour of the Pacific. So far, the trip has been largely ceremonial. The President and Mrs. Bush saw New Year's Eve fireworks in Sydney, Australia. But Mr. Bush will be seeking concessions to improve trading ties on this trip, especially when he moves on to Japan next week with an entourage of American CEOs. News analyst Daniel Shore looks ahead to that part of the trip.
It's good that these business people are going along, says President Bush, America's statesman salesman. He is resolutely refusing to concede that taking a delegation of 21 tycoons to Japan may have been one of his less inspired ideas. Already there's been some political fallout at home. Democratic candidate Bill Clinton, for example, has sounded off about CEOs who symbolize an economy built on paper and perks instead of people and products. And Mario Cuomo, the non-silent non-candidate, has weighed in by calling it a truly dumb idea to be promoting in Asia the cause of rich business people rather than laid-off workers. But the worst is yet to come. In Japan next week, the high-level trade mission will be vulnerable to a certain amount of America bashing unless it comes with open minds as well as open mouths. Reports in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere indicate that Japanese officialdom and businessdom have zeroed in on the phenomenon of executives whose personal earnings seem to increase as their company earnings plummet. Japan basher Lee Iacocca, for example. His salary and extras add up to more than $5 million last year, which is one of the worst years for Chrysler Motors. The 12 CEOs of major American corporations who are on the trip average more than $2 million a year. The average Japanese chief executive gets $300,000 to $400,000 a year. And it is customary in Japan to take a voluntary pay cut to atone for planning mistakes. Rewarding oneself for failure, Ralph Nader calls this uniquely American more for less phenomenon. It is associated with an era of takeovers and junk bonds and the sacrificing of long-term performance for short-term profits. It is also only in America, the Japanese point out, that an auto executive averages 160 times the pay of an assembly line worker. In Japan, the ratio is 16 to 1. And so when President Bush accuses the Japanese of raising trade barriers, they are likely to argue that America raises competitive barriers against itself. Cultural and systemic differences between America and Japan are hard to reconcile at best. But in a campaign year atmosphere in which President Bush and his bevy of CEOs go to Japan to make political points at home, the prospects for accommodation seem not very bright. This is Daniel Shore.
American business may be experiencing a dismal time, but this country's annual output of top 10 lists has not diminished. You've read them, you've heard them, but you've not heard them all, not yet, but you're about to.
In the interest of brevity, we have time for only top 5 lists of 1991, some thoughts that we solicited today about the really important things in life.
My name is Lloyd Stoyer, and I'm editor of Modern Tire Dealer magazine. And I'm responding to an inquiry about what might be the 5 most interesting tires of the year. I would pick for number 1 a Pirelli tire made for the Lamborghini LM002. It's made, called a Scorpion, made to, if the tire goes flat, to run on the sidewalls. And they're available for about $2,000 each. Number 2 is a Michelin tire called the XH4. It's a passenger tire with an 80,000-mile limited warranty. Tied for fourth place would be a couple of tires of the future. Goodyear calls theirs the Greater Fuel Efficiency Tire, or GFE. It's a passenger tire that supposedly will increase your gas mileage by about 4% and decrease the rolling resistance on your tires by about 20%. Also coming very shortly is a similar tire called the XFE, made by Michelin. These could be the tires of the future. Number five, I would say, is the twin tire. This tire is also very good for traction, but requires two tires on each wheel. So you need a set of four wheels and eight tires, which can be yours for about $3,000.
This is Andrew von Nobelsdorf. I'm the director of publicity at Manolo Blahnik in New York and London. And our top five selling shoes for this year, starting with the spring, the number one was a Salem Mule, which was a black patent mule with a pilgrim buckle for $415. And then we had a strappy slingback, which was the number two, called the Clotta at $415. The number three, when going into kind of the fall season, it was a Cletia boot with rhinestone buckles. And then a Sidara evening short shoe was number four, which was a satin and crepe Dorset pump with a rhinestone buckle, which sold for $650. And then finally, our number five shoe would be a VT, which is a resort shoe, and it is a thong mule made of Napa for $385.
In a more edible top five realm, the five most popular items at the Piggly Wiggly store number two in Natchez, Mississippi.
Number one is Crunchin' Munch caramel popcorn. Two, Jiffy corn muffin mix. Three, Del Monte vegetables. Four, Miss Tucker's shortening. Five, Coca-Cola products.
That's Ricky Goodman, the store's manager.
The year's top colors from Hanover Park, Illinois, comes the list of Pat Verlo. She's a color consultant and president of the Color Marketing Group. Her number one pick.
Tickled teal, a very fun, sporty color. You see a lot in sports cars and sportswear. It kind of brings everybody up to life. Next one is Unprecedented Purple. Purple is a very individual color, a color that says, I'm me and no one else. Optimistic Blue, or What Me Worry Blue, a blue that is reminiscent of blue skies, and everybody likes blue. The other one is In the Pink. It's a cheer-up, cheery kind of pink, and it comes in very light and very bright shades. And last but not least is Cozy Peach, peach that people are very, very comfortable with, and it's very popular in all the way across the line in cosmetics and fashion and home furnishings.
Now, any listing of top five lists has to include someone's personal best. Ed Barreto spent the year running marathons, 75 of them. Each raced more than 26 miles. That's a world record.
Number five would be finishing the last marathon, number 75. It was a real high because I achieved what I set out to do. Number four, I just happened to see two mallard ducks on the road, and the female had been hit by a car. And the male was just sitting there with his little mate, and that kind of broke me up. I realized that, you know, things can happen in life. Okay, number three. Well, number three was probably when Bill Rogers told me that even though I'm slowpoke, he couldn't do what I'm doing either, so I should be considering myself in the same class as him. And number two probably has to do with the physical fitness that I experienced from this, and that was the fact that I had a tremendous physical checkup. Blood pressure was like 100 over 70, and my cholesterol is about 90, and my resting pulse is like 45, 50. For 54 years old, he said I looked like about a 27-year-old guy. Number one, going backwards, of course, that was when my whole family and my banker, because it takes a lot of money, gave me the go-ahead and had a little party just making the decision and saying, yes, go ahead, go for it, just do it.
Ed Barreto of Maggie Valley, North Carolina.
How about the newborn names of the year from McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh? Claire Koslowski starts with the boys.
The number fifth name this year was Zachary. Number four was Kevin. Number three is Christopher, number two was Michael, and number one was David. Now, the five girls' names for this year were, number five was Renee, number four was Kimberly, number three was Chelsea, number two was Courtney, And the number one winner of them all was Emily.
Hi, I'm Ava Phoenix from San Diego's Tattoo Land. And the top five tattoo designs for 1991 are as follows. Number five would be lettering, your boyfriend or girlfriend's name. Number four, a tribal design. Number three, dragons. Number two, roses. And the number one tattoo design in 1991 is the Black Panther crawling up your arm.
Well, then, there's the list of the top 10 films of the year. Fewer movie tickets were sold in 1991 than at any time in the last 15 years. Some attribute that decline to the combined effects of the recession and the Gulf War. In any case, our critic Bob Mondello was able to muster his annual year-end roster of cinematic selections.
I remember it seemed as if the movie year would never get started, maybe because events in the Persian Gulf were more dramatic last January than anything Hollywood could think of. It wasn't until April that a really interesting movie came along, and it was an odd one, a comedy called Impromptu about 19th century novelist George Sand and her rocky romance with the composer Chopin.
Yeah! Oh, don't stop! Monsieur Chopin, you're in the middle of a miracle. I'm not quite yet cured.
If Impromptu was the year's funniest love story, a foreign film called The Vanishing had to be its most chilling. Hitchcock could have made this delicate Dutch tale about a woman who simply disappears while driving on vacation with her boyfriend. He spends the rest of the movie trying to discover what happened to her, ultimately finding out, both to his and the audience's, horror. Also paying homage to Hitchcock was Kenneth Branagh, whose Dead Again is as brilliant as his Henry V was 2 years ago. Dead Again is two separate thrillers, one in black and white, the other in color, intertwined with a brilliant twist involving hypnosis.
How far back are you?
1948.
Hypnosis can take us back to our past lives.
You expect me just to run with that?
What do you see?
Mr. Skull?
Dead Again is so much fun, I ended up seeing it three times, which is something millions of children will insist on doing with a new Disney classic, the year's most lush and musical romance, Beauty and the Beast. This one's not just for kids. If there's any justice, Beauty and the Beast will be the first cartoon ever nominated for Best Picture, come Oscar time, where it will probably be competing with a much more down-to-earth tale called Grand Canyon, which has only opened in New York and Los Angeles so far. Grand Canyon is a story of inner-city tensions from the maker of The Big Chill. It feels so real, you may be amazed to find that it also feels optimistic. That's something you could also say about a subversive little British comedy called Life is Sweet, about a family living on the edge of poverty. As befits its subject matter, the film makes a virtue of a microscopic budget. But smallness wasn't everything. For once, the year's most popular and expensive film also turned out to be one of its best. I never thought I'd say this, but Arnold Schwarzenegger is terrific in Terminator 2. Okay, so shoot me. The film's a fun park ride that does what it sets out to do absolutely brilliantly. Despite Terminator's lock on the box office, reality played a big role in this year's best films, from the tremendously emotional Paris is Burning, a documentary about New York's transvestite clubs, to a delightful little Canadian gem called Strangers in Good Company, in which seven elderly women use their wits to survive when their bus breaks down 20 miles from the nearest telephone. The situation is fictional, but the women, none of whom are actresses, play themselves wonderfully. Fictionalized reality is also at the root of JFK, Oliver Stone's controversial tale of one man's obsessive pursuit of the truth after the Kennedy assassination.
Y'all gotta start thinking on a different level, like the CIA does. Now we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white. Just maybe Oswald is exactly what he said he was. Patsy.
Whatever you think of the conspiracy theories Stone puts forth, you'll be blown away by his filmmaking. 10, of course, is an arbitrary number. Quite a few films got squeezed off my list, enough to keep me smiling even as I contemplate the new year, which will bring us such potential classics as The Lawnmower Man and A Gnome Named Norm. Can you wait? I'm Bob Mondello.
The failed Russian coup and the U.S. recession. Anita discussing the Coke can in question. McDonald's debuting its new mighty wings. These were a few of the year's biggest things. Ted in a t-shirt without any bottom. Art Kent the scud stud reporting on Sodom. Bush riding high on the ratings war brings. These were a few of the year's biggest things. When the Donald dumped the Marla and she looked so sad, I simply remember that she got the ring, and then I don't feel so bad. Liz Taylor's wedding to some guy named Larry. Bob Maxwell's dip off the Isle of Canary. Mario throwing his hat in the ring. These were a few of the year's biggest things. Dave Duke becoming a national leader. Pee-wee enjoying himself in a theater. Sununu in doo-doo for pulling some strings. These were a few of the year's biggest things. When the Arabs and Israelis meet but go home mad, I simply remember this year's almost done, and then I don't feel so bad.
Lyrics by Lenore Scanese, music by Richard Rogers. They worked separately. Julie Stewart was the singer, Ellen Mandel the keyboard player.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On the last day of the year, long lines formed in Moscow as the new year brings to Russia an end to many subsidized state prices. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has ordered price limits on some basic items, including bread, milk, and sugar. However, prices of these items will also go up by as much as 5 times when stores open again Thursday. Meanwhile, Yeltsin has been strongly criticized by his vice president in an interview with a German magazine. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The Commonwealth of Independent States is ruled by the most repulsive form of dictatorship, the rule of the streets, according to Russian Vice President Alexander Rutskoy. In an interview with the German newsweekly Stern, Rutskoy said Boris Yeltsin is helpless against this rule. He says the Russian president issues decrees that no one carries out. Furthermore, the decisions made by Yeltsin are often senseless and incomprehensible, according to the vice president. Just as the Soviet Union fell apart, Rutskoy warns, so can Russia. Meanwhile, the Bonn government today recognized 7 republics in the Commonwealth. Bonn had previously recognized Russia and the Ukraine. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Bergen, Frankfurt.
In the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, both sides in the current civil unrest appear to be adding to their forces. Opposition guns have been set up outside the parliament building, where the president has taken refuge, and government troops moved a tank into the center of the city. While the capital has been quiet today, the movement of heavy weapons has indicated that more fighting is on the way. Homes near the parliament building have no heat or electricity. In addition to the three Baltic states, Georgia is the only former Soviet republic not to join the new Commonwealth. After 3 days of talks, officials from North and South Korea have agreed to a ban on nuclear weapons in the two nations. NPR's Deborah Wong reports from Seoul.
South Korean officials say the agreement calls for a ban on the manufacture, possession, or deployment of nuclear weapons and on the building of nuclear reprocessing facilities. The two sides have agreed to allow joint inspections of suspected nuclear sites and to set up a joint committee to monitor compliance. South Korean officials say in addition to the six-point plan, the North has agreed to sign the International Nuclear Safeguards Agreement. In return, the South will put a halt to its annual military exercises with the United States, scheduled for early spring. Officials say they will watch the North closely to make sure it complies with the agreement. There are widespread fears the North is within several years of developing a nuclear device. I'm Deborah Wong in Seoul.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 5 points to close at 3,168.83 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The State Department says that Iraq will set free two Americans jailed on charges of entering the country illegally from Kuwait. The Americans were arrested more than 3 weeks ago in an unmarked border area. But U.S. officials were not told of this until last week. State Department officials say that they have been notified that arrangements are being made to deport the two men who have not been identified. A spokesman says this incident underlines the danger of traveling in the border area. Iraq cut diplomatic relations with the U.S. during the Persian Gulf War. In New Hampshire, a debate is planned between candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. As Martin Murray of member station WEVO reports, the number of people taking part in the upcoming event will be limited.
Just six of the 36 official Democratic candidates are invited to the January 19th debate. State Party Chairman Chris Spiro said there's not enough time and not a big enough auditorium to include all the candidates. He said he invited those he feels can beat President Bush. Candidate Larry Agron recently forced his way into a forum on health care and isn't happy with the plans.
Who are these self-appointed gatekeepers who decide which voices shall and shall not be heard by the American people? I'm fed up with these exclusionary practices, and I think you ought to be as well.
Candidates invited to the debate are Jerry Brown, Bill Clinton, Tom Harkin, Bob Kerry, Paul Tsongas, and Doug Wilder. For National Public Radio, I'm Martin Murray in Concord, New Hampshire.
President Bush is now in Australia, the first stop on his 12-day trip to the Far East. Mr. Bush's talks with high-ranking officials are expected to center on economic problems and a military alliance linking Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major currencies. I'm Ann Taylor, NPR News, in Washington.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Noah Adams. When President Bush signed the Civil Rights Act of 1991 into law on November 21st, it seemed to end 2 years of political warfare over civil rights legislation. But now another controversy has arisen. The government agency charged with enforcing the law, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, says the new law does not apply to cases where the alleged discrimination occurred before November 21st. Some civil rights lawyers say the EEOC has misinterpreted the intent of Congress. NPR's Mara Liasson has our report.
The 1991 Act made it easier for victims to prove their cases and allowed them to collect punitive and compensatory damages for discrimination of up to $300,000. But just how Congress meant to apply the law to the tens of thousands of pending discrimination cases is unclear. The Civil Rights Act does specify that some provisions in it are not meant to be retroactive, but it never explicitly states that the rest of the provisions are retroactive. The EEOC resolves some discrimination cases itself and takes others to the courts. Yesterday, the commission issued guidelines for applying the law. Those guidelines acknowledge that the law could be interpreted either way. Reginald Welch is the EEOC's director of communications. He says that before the commission decided against retroactivity, it looked to previous Supreme Court rulings for guidance.
We freely admit that there is ambiguity here. There is some inconsistency here. The law is explicit in some areas and it's not explicit in other areas. Right now, there are several court decisions out there that go both ways on this issue. We just had to analyze it, make a determination of which way to go on this.
Richard Seymour is a lawyer with the nonprofit Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. He argues that the Civil Rights Act is a lot clearer on the issue of retroactivity than the EEOC says it is. But Seymour admits it would have been a lot easier if Congress had included a simple sentence saying that the law was meant to be retroactive with certain exceptions.
What happened with the bill was that the sponsors agreed to disagree, and what they agreed to do was to use language in which both sides could argue, the president could argue that he had won, the Democratic majority in the House and the Senate could argue that they had prevailed on this subject as well as on several others.
Because Congress and the president were not able to resolve the conflict over retroactivity, they left the final decision up to the courts. If the matter reaches the Supreme Court, some civil rights lawyers predict the conservative majority there will side with the commission and decide the law is not retroactive. In the meantime, Richard Seymour says, the EEOC has undercut the intention of the law and has left people with pending discrimination claims in the lurch.
The issue is that this is an enforcement agency. It gets hundreds of millions of dollars for one purpose only, to enforce the law. The statement that it released yesterday admits that there are strong arguments for applying the law to pending cases, but without any explanation, it refuses to make those announcements. It's decided to take a dive on those issues.
Seymour says that people who either have cases before the EEOC or whose cases are being handled in the courts by EEOC lawyers would do better to hire their own counsel. Private counsel, Seymour says, will argue what the EEOC will not, that the new law with its tough new remedies does apply to them. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
When we hear about migrant farm workers, many of us think of Hispanic immigrants or Haitians who come to this country, work for low wages, and live in ramshackle labor camps. But legal advisors for farm workers say that some of the worst migrant labor conditions in this country can be found on crews made up of American citizens, usually black Americans, homeless men who are picked up off the streets and recruited to join migrant crews. The U.S. Labor Department now is suing the leader of one such crew for wage and hour violations in North Carolina. Three men who worked on the crew, picking sweet potatoes, say that they were held in virtual slavery and paid nothing for their work. From member station WUNC, Adam Hochberg reports.
Michael Scott says he spent his summer as a slave, working on a migrant labor crew picking sweet potatoes in North Carolina. He says he made no money no matter how hard he worked, and armed guards prevented him from escaping.
I felt oppressed and I felt indentured in one way, form, or another. We're constantly under surveillance. You would be beat into submission. They did the same thing that had happened to the black people when they were brought to this country.
Scott, along with Vant King and George Smith, were recruited for the farm jobs in Atlanta, where they had been unemployed, living on the streets or in rooming houses. All three say they had drug and alcohol problems at the time. They were approached at a soup kitchen by a man who promised them good wages and decent food and housing if they joined the migrant crew. Vant King says it sounded like a good opportunity until he got to the migrant camp and saw the conditions there.
You know, the living quarters where we were living at, they were filthy. The walls were molded and mildewed. There were no towels to take a shower with or washcloth or stuff like this. A homeless person to live in paradise compared to being there because it was just inhuman.
After just a few days at the camp, the men knew they wanted out, but they say the crew leader wouldn't allow them to leave. They describe a system of indentured servitude at the camp. Workers had money deducted from their pay for rent and food, for liquor and for cigarettes. The total of the deductions was higher than the amount of money they were supposed to earn in the field. So Smith says the more they worked, the more they owed, and they were told they couldn't leave the camp until they found a way to pay off the debt.
It came to the point where if you tried to leave, they had what they would call, what they call Rottweilers, which were, they're not dogs, they're guys, just big guys that that would actually beat you up and bring you back.
Smith says he and the others were finally able to outsmart the Rottweilers and escape the camp in the dark of night. They walked 40 miles to Raleigh and ended up at an office of the U.S. Labor Department. They told their story to department investigators. It was the kind of story those investigators say they've heard many times before.
There are rampant violations out there where we have unpaid employees or underpaid employees. You know, and I am convinced that every once in a while someone may suffer a beating of some kind.
Jim Whitmer is with the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division. Much of his time is spent trying to stop unfair labor practices on migrant camps. He says the people who run the sweet potato camps are among the worst offenders.
The sweet potato harvest is one where there has historically been a number of bad actors, kind of notorious crew leaders, and there are still a lot of hangers-on for that harvest.
One of those crew leaders is Kerry Bonds, who ran the sweet potato camp where Michael Scott, Vant King, and George Smith worked. After hearing the workers' complaints about Bonds, the Labor Department filed a lawsuit against her. It alleges that she hasn't paid her workers the wages they've earned, and it charges that the camps where she housed them didn't meet safety and health standards. It's not the first time the government has gone after Bonds and her family. The government revoked her husband's license to operate migrant labor crews and has tried to revoke her license as well. But that case is tied up in court. Until it's resolved, Mrs. Bonds can continue to operate migrant camps. She's now in Georgia, running a camp on an onion farm, with many of the same workers she used in North Carolina. Bonds didn't return our phone calls, but when she was confronted at the onion farm by a reporter from WRAL Television, she defended the way she treats her workers.
I consider myself a good employer.
Bond said she never has held workers against their will. She claimed that she pays them fairly, has never harmed them, and said they can leave the camp whenever they want. Bonds called the allegations against her lies made by disgruntled former workers so they can win money from her through legal settlements.
They have heard these wage and hour peoples. The legal aid people say, if you're not treated right, you let us know, and we can get your money back, and we can get your money here, and we can get your money there. So you take people that don't want to work, ain't never done nothing but laid up in the mission, and ate free, and slept free. Well, if I go out here on this camp, and I'll do this, and I'll do that, and then I'll go and say this here, and I'll get me a lump sum of money.
To help prove her side of the story, Bonds presented to the television reporter some other people who have worked on her camps. Franklin Smith, and a man who would give his name only as Woody, said the living conditions are good.
I like the way I'm treated. It's no Holiday Inn, but the food's good. You get as much of it as you want. And they treat me fair.
I don't see how they can have any complaints. They were still getting fed, still having a place to stay. And I don't see what their complaints could be.
Those positive comments from some workers don't surprise the attorneys who represent migrants. After all, they say, many of the workers were living on the streets before they joined the crew. The lawyers claim crew leaders, like Kerry Bonds, purposely recruit homeless people, people who the crew leaders hope would be happy just to have a roof over their heads. Mary Lee Hall of Farm Worker Legal Services says many of the worst crew leaders end up on sweet potato farms. She says there's not much money to be made in sweet potatoes, so the good crew leaders end up working in other crops that are more profitable. That leaves the bad ones for the sweet potato harvest.
The piece rates in sweet potatoes have always been rather low, so that it was always very hard and barely minimum wage work, so it was never very attractive work. And that's why those particular crew leaders, whose business really is to take their workers' money, ended up in sweet potato camps.
Hall blames the problems not just on the crew leaders, but also on the farmers and produce distributors who hire the crew leaders. For years, Farm Worker Legal Services has had a running battle with Bob Bassetti, the owner of this huge potato packing plant in Benson, North Carolina. Bassetti's company hired Kerry Bonds to run the migrant labor crew where Michael Scott, Vant King, and George Smith worked. Farm Worker Legal Services says he should pay the workers back wages. Bassetti claims it's not his responsibility. He says he can barely keep track of the migrant crews while they're working on the farm, let alone after they go back to the camps at night.
How is a farmer supposed to regulate, or anybody supposed to regulate, what a crew does after they go home from the fields? Other than the fact that we took care of the camp for a lady here in renting the camp, I don't see how they can even associate themselves with it.
But despite Bassetti's efforts to distance himself from the behavior of his crew leaders, others in the sweet potato business concede their industry could take a more active role to improve working conditions for migrants. At the offices of the North Carolina Sweet Potato Commission, an industry trade group, an old picture hangs on the wall. It shows slaves in the 19th century picking potatoes by hand. Commission Director Billy Juergen admits that the conditions on some farms today are still about the same.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it really has not changed a lot since then. That picture's not so antiquated, even though it was 1863.
Jürgen insists he wants to solve the problem of crew leaders exploiting migrant workers, but he says his efforts have received little support from farmers. Jürgen now is lobbying in Washington for research funds to develop machines that can take the place of farm workers on sweet potato fields.
I honestly and truly would like to see no jobs available for migrants in this state in 10 years. Then we can let the Kerry Bonds wonder what happened. And then we can let Farm Workers Legal Services find another cause that maybe they can represent the machinery.
Two of the migrant workers who came forward to complain about the conditions in the camp, Vant King and George Smith, now are living in Raleigh. They found jobs at one of the city's finest hotels. Smith is a pastry chef. King is his apprentice. Michael Scott, who holds college degrees in psychology and sociology, now is living and working at a mission for the homeless. He calls it a paradise compared to the camp. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
There are probably few places in this country as close spiritually to Africa as coastal South Carolina and Georgia. The descendants of slaves there never fully lost the speech patterns and traditions of their home continent. Folklorist Nick Spitzer certainly found this to be true in the region's New Year's Eve celebrations in McIntosh County, Georgia, at the Mount Calvary Baptist Church, a few miles of marsh from the Atlantic Ocean.
Lord, I thank you for this journey that you brought me. Oh, you brought me from my
This small community of black rice farmers and shrimp fishermen, known to locals as the Briar Patch, New Year's Eve is called Watch Night. It's a blending of Christian and African ritual and celebration. Watch Night starts with a church service of songs and testimony that runs past midnight.
Lord, I thank you for the journey that you brought me. Oh, you brought me from all along.
We sing the song, praising the Lord that He brought us through the old year into a new one.
Oh, you brought me from a long, long way.
But do you know, you get on one knee at 12 o'clock and say our praise and wait till the new year roll in. Yeah. That's the tradition from the old folks.
The voices of elders Lawrence McIver and Odessa Young. They are leaders of the ring shout that takes place after the regular church service ends. The shout is one of the oldest, most continuous African music and movement forms in the New World. It involves a circling line of stepping women known as shouters, a male rhythm section, a song leader, and community chorus. The holiday shouts once ran a full week, each night from Christmas to New Year's, as shouters went from house to house or used the plantation barn. Now people pack into the church social hall on New Year's Eve for the shout and a feast on shrimp and oysters, black-eyed peas and rice, ham and biscuits, pies and chocolates. The shout hall is a warm, bright dot of light on the winter's night coast.
My mother learned me, and the way she tell us about it, it was praising God. The older folks was praising God. They was in slavery, and that's the only chance they had to praise God. It was done in the wintertime. Most wasn't going to let them do it in the summertime. They had to work. They didn't have nothing to do in the wintertime, so he let them have the barn, and that's the only place they had to shout. They had little huts, and it wasn't big enough to do no shouting in. Just a little place they could stay. So they was glad to get this.
My children, you are free.
Oh, my Lord.
My God give you liberty.
Ah, Lord, you're free.
Call us a Sunday Christian.
Oh.
sit in a semicircle. One called the stick man keeps time with a broom or hoe as work implements become musical instruments. The songs tell a story of emancipation or worship, of thanks for bounty or hope for better times to come. The singers, some waving their arms, respond to this call, while up to a dozen women in long dresses with gold hoop earrings and bright color head wraps step to the beat in a snaking counterclockwise line.
I rock that little sauce. I rock that little sauce. Now shake that little sauce. Oh, shake that little sauce. Oh, shake that little sauce. Oh, rock that little sauce. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sing your little
sauce. A ring shout is a tradition that come from Africa. Our black folks brought it here, and they use it on down through the generation until it come down to us, and we doing the same thing, singing the same song, and that's the whole story. Believe me, if you want to, it's naturally come from Africa.
Tell everybody
so sweet
about your little
so sweet.
Cause it made me happy.
So sweet.
Although there is upbeat music for the ring shout, and the swaying shuffle step of the shouters might look like a dance, Odessa Young insists it's not.
It's a certain way you're supposed to do it. You keep your feet on the floor. See? You just keep your feet on the floor and you shout like this. But your feet must be on the floor now. You can't cross your feet because you'll be dancing if you do.
Benjamin Lee keeps time for the shout with a broomstick.
I just love to see them gals get on the floor, and I beat that stick and I look at them, they're making that ring shout. I mean, it makes you feel good. You know, if you go to rapping the stick and they're moving right, you can beat that stick all night long.
This song, Kneebone in the Wilderness, summarizes the plight of slaves caught between the religious expression of Africa and the newly imposed Christianity that they would shape to their purposes in the plantation frontier of America.
That's the oldest slave song they tell me that come from across since black folks come in to America. We got it. We got it. Kneebone in the wilderness.
They used to do it in slavery time. That's when it originated. And they thought that they could make up some songs, that they could praise God, and that he would hear them. And he did, and he removed it too.
He removed slavery.
Yes, he did. He removed it. Slavery is gone. Thank God for it. It's gone. That's what shouting is all about.
Well, Happy New Year.
Yes, same to you. Happy New Year.
Goodbye, 1991. Oh, goodbye, 1991. I was here when you came in. Thank God I live to see you when you gone. Out of the dawn is the coming of a new year. Out of the dawn, there comes a new year. Thank God I live to see when you come. Lord, I don't know if I'll be here to see you when you're gone. But I say goodbye, 1991.
Lawrence McIver with a new Watch Night song he'll sing tonight. I'm Nick Spitzer.
Goodbye, members.
Farewell, last time. Farewell.
This is the last.
Farewell, last time. Farewell.
I had to leave you.
Farewell, last time. Farewell.
But I hope to see you.
Farewell, last time. Farewell.
Another time.
Farewell, last time. Farewell.
Goodbye, members.
Farewell, last time. Farewell.
This is the last.
Farewell.
To see you.
It's All Things Considered. Support for this program is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Ford Foundation, for the coverage of science, the National Science Foundation. For support of NPR's news coverage in the Persian Gulf, University of Texas Station KUT and its members and underwriters. And Micro-Age Computer Centers, providing computer solutions for business and professionals around the world. This program's a production of NPR, which is solely responsible for its content. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You're tuned to KCRW Santa Monica, a community service of Santa Monica College, at 89.9 FM, National Public Radio for most of Southern California. Coming up at 7 o'clock this evening, following news from NPR, it's our holiday special, Politics Takes a Holiday, New Year's Eve special, The Capitol Steps. KCRW thanks Los Angeles Magazine for its support. The January issue of Los Angeles includes a special fitness section to help you get in shape for the new year, plus film critic Rod Lurie's outrageous picks for the best and worst films of 1991. It's all in Los Angeles Magazine, the magazine Southern California lives by.
Sig alert in Orange County for the 57 freeway. Northbound, the Imperial Highway off-ramp is closed, all due to police activity. That continues until further notice. Traffic right now backs up at Yorba Linda Road. If your plans are to take the San Rafael on-ramp to the Ventura eastbound, there's a two-car accident clearing over to the right shoulder. Another accident clearing out of the right lane. Santa Monica eastbound transition to the harbor southbound. And on the Ventura westbound before Van Nuys Boulevard, vehicles stalled out in traffic. They're clearing it over to the center divider. It's Metro Traffic Report made possible by Gourmet Pride Soup. I'm Barbara Brooks on KCRW.
Special, this New Year's Day, a marathon reprise of the KCRW Symphony Space co-production of Selected Shorts, recorded at the Getty Museum. Beginning at 9 a.m., we will again air this series of short stories by some of the world's most renowned authors, read by some of our most exciting and accomplished actors. Selected Shorts West, 9 a.m. till 3 p.m., New Year's Day, on KCRW Santa Monica. All Things Considered from NPR continues until 7 o'clock. This broadcast time is made possible in part by a grant from the men and women of McDonnell Douglas West. The time is 6:01.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar delayed his departure from the United Nations today to oversee the completion of a peace agreement for El Salvador. The UN chief acknowledged that there are still obstacles to ending the 12-year Salvadoran civil war, but he said he was confident that an agreement will be reached today. Negotiators for the rebel side said that problems still remain over the issue of land reform, but they indicated that the talks were not in serious danger. Government representatives said they also believe a peace agreement can be concluded before Perez de Cuellar's term is complete, 3 hours from now. Iraq has notified the State Department it will free two American businessmen who've been in jail in Baghdad for more than 3 weeks. They were accused of illegally entering the country from Kuwait. Barry Schwide has more.
The U.S. and Iraq, which have had no diplomatic relations since the height of the Persian Gulf War in February, used Polish diplomats in Baghdad and the Algerian embassy in Washington to work out the release. Iraq, which accused the businessmen of violating Iraqi territory, gets a little face-saving by holding proceedings against the Americans and then deporting them. The U.S., the businessmen, and their families gain the Americans' freedom. They've been held since December 6th, but according to the State Department, the U.S. government didn't know about it until Christmas Day. That led to jail visits by a Polish diplomat, a medical checkup, a protest, and their imminent freedom. According to the State Department, the businessmen were arrested in an unmarked part of the Iraqi-Kuwaiti border, which U.S. citizens have been warned to avoid. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Five more Texas counties have been declared federal disaster areas. Floodwaters have swept several parts of the state for 2 weeks, claiming at least 16 lives. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF reports.
13 Texas counties are now eligible for federal disaster assistance, most in the north and central parts of the state, where torrential rains flooded cities 10 days ago. But those floodwaters continue to head downstream, threatening southeast Texans along the Trinity and Brazos Rivers. The Brazos was expected to crest today, but local officials say it continues to inch higher and the worst may not come until Thursday, when up to 200 homes may be flooded. The Trinity River is expected to reach its highest point Friday, affecting about 3,500 residents. Low-lying neighborhoods along both rivers already have flooded roads, but officials say many people won't evacuate because they fear looting. So authorities are stockpiling rescue equipment, preparing to save trapped residents. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 5 points to close at a record 3,168.8. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of about 248 million shares. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia's federal presidency agreed today to a United Nations plan to deploy peacekeeping forces in Croatia, but it's a plan that won't go into effect until the current fighting stops. Croatian radio reported heavy fighting around the Adriatic port city of Zadar and around cities east and south of the capital, Zagreb. United Nations envoy Cyrus Vance said that the fighting appears to be even more severe than it was the last time he was in Croatia. The fighting continues despite a series of ceasefires agreed to by the Serbian-dominated Federal Army and its presidency, which is also controlled by Serbia and its allies. As investigations continue into the deaths of 8 young people at a charity basketball game in Harlem last Saturday, there are questions about whether the organization that was supposed to benefit from the proceeds really exists. From New York, NPR's Maeve McGoran has more.
Spokespersons for both the New York Charities Registration Bureau and the New York Department of State say the AIDS Education Outreach Program, the charity named on flyers for the City College basketball game, does not appear on any of their lists of nonprofit groups. New York law requires any organization that solicits more than $25,000 a year for charity to register with the state. The New York Daily News reported today that total proceeds for the City College event, a celebrity basketball game featuring a number of rap stars, is estimated at about $60,000. I'm Maeve McGoran in New York.
Iran is seeking international assistance to repair the damage it suffered during the Iran-Iraq War. The United Nations released a report today in which Iran claims to have suffered more than $97 billion in damage during the 8-year conflict. About 3 weeks ago, UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar issued a finding that Iraq was to blame for starting the war. UN officials have denied that there was any link between the finding and Iran's cooperation in obtaining the release of Western hostages. This is NPR. The government's index of leading indicators fell 0.3% in November, pulled down by a drop in consumer confidence and a big increase in weekly claims for unemployment benefits. The drop was the biggest setback in 10 months for the government's main tool for predicting future economic activity. The index provided new backing for economists who say the economy is slipping into a second round of recession after a brief recovery. More optimistic forecasters cite the year-end stock market surge and the latest drop in interest rates as signs that the economy is improving. The governors of Alabama, Florida, and Georgia will meet in Montgomery, Alabama on Friday to sign a truce in the water wars between the states. Jim Merlini reports.
A 10-year drought and falling water tables in the southeast have the three states struggling over river water, specifically water that originates above Atlanta and flows down the Chattahoochee River across the Florida Panhandle into the Gulf of Mexico, and also into rivers flowing across Alabama. A rapidly growing Atlanta wanted more water, and that began the legal war. More upstream use meant more water pollution, and Florida and Alabama said no. The signing will end the threats of lawsuits, but Alabama Governor Guy Hunt's press secretary says adamantly it's only a temporary settlement. Water wars in the southeast will continue, but on an administrative, not judicial, level. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Merlini in Montgomery, Alabama.
Japan's prime minister said today that he'll ask Japanese automakers to help increase the sales of U.S.-made cars and car parts in Japan. Kiichi Miyazawa said that he'd remind the Japanese manufacturers of the current problems the U.S. auto industry is facing, symbolized by the recent announcements of layoffs at General Motors. The prime minister's statement comes just as his country is preparing for a visit from President Bush, accompanied by the heads of the big three U.S. car makers. The president has said he'll press Japan to open its markets. This is NPR News.
The This is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Robert Siegel. As the new year begins, Russia is due for yet another historic change. More than 70 years of state economic planning will officially end tomorrow, to be replaced by a free market system. Prices for more goods and services will be freed from government control. Shops and businesses will become eligible to be privately owned, and the government will aim to balance its budget. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Moscow.
There were long lines outside stores in Moscow today. It was the last day of subsidized prices, the last day of artificially cheap bread, milk, sugar, meat, and vodka. The last day, in effect, for socialism in Russia. Tomorrow, most stores will be closed for the New Year's holiday. When they open on Thursday, store managers will have the freedom to set prices as high as the market can bear. Some basic items will have price ceilings, but the new limits will be 3 to 5 times higher than current levels. It will be Russia's first big taste of free market economics. In an end-of-the-year television address this week, President Boris Yeltsin told the Russian people that market reforms, though painful, are necessary in order to cure the serious economic disease from which Russia is suffering. The lifting of price controls will be accompanied, Yeltsin explained, by budget reform, sharp cutbacks in government spending, and by an ambitious plan to privatize state-owned businesses in Russia. In such sectors as food, construction, retail services, and light industry, Yeltsin predicted, fully half of all state enterprises will be in private hands by the end of 1992. It is time, Yeltsin said, to completely recognize the notion of private property and land, including the right to buy and sell land. And we cannot waste any time in recognizing this right. Mikhail Gorbachev was never able to utter those words. The Russian parliament could not bring itself to legalize private property. Yeltsin himself is having to resort to presidential decree. There is still plenty of opposition to market reforms here, from Yeltsin's own vice president, for example, who warns of impending chaos. Some of the skepticism suggests a lack of understanding of how free markets work in relation to forces of supply and demand. Boris Isaev, chairman of the Committee on Social Protection in the Russian parliament, is supporting privatization only on the condition that new owners of retail shops promise to continue selling whatever the state previously dictated should be sold. For the time being, maybe for a year, specialization of the shops is going to be preserved, Isaev says. We cannot allow them to turn themselves into offices immediately. Under the privatization plan to be implemented this year, the new owner of a privatized bakery must promise to continue selling bread rather than switch, say, to cassette tapes or shoes. There are other examples that reveal a strong, lingering mistrust of free enterprise. Russian lawmakers, for example, have decided to continue requiring the propiska, a sort of passport for use inside the country. Russian citizens living outside Moscow cannot move to the city unless they first get a propiska, a pass. Russian parliamentarians say the propiska system must be maintained for now because if people are free to move to Moscow on their own, there won't be enough housing for them. They do not recognize that supply and demand forces in that case will have the same effect as the propiska. Boris Pinksner, an economist advising the Moscow city government on its own privatization plan, says he's continually frustrated by the failure of Russian politicians to understand and accept market economics, but he insists privatization in Moscow will work because the store managers he meets are ready and eager to take over their shops. Some enthusiastic supporters of market reforms, in fact, may be as naive in their hopes as skeptics are irrational in their fears. Politicians who advocate the reforms have taken to promising the Russian people that life will be noticeably better in just a few months, that privatization will by itself bring a quick improvement in the standard of living for even the average working family. The truth is, no one knows how this year will go. With their country making a huge shift from one economic system to another, Russians can only cross their fingers that it will be a successful turn. I'm Tom Gelton in Moscow.
Today in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, both sides in an armed confrontation were said to have called in more troops. Rebel National Guardsmen are opposing President Fiad Gamzakhurdia, who remains inside the parliament building in the capital city, Tbilisi, with several hundred loyal soldiers defending him. There was a fierce battle yesterday in Tbilisi, but it produced no change in the situation. Gamzukurdia has been inside the parliament building for at least a week, refusing demands that he resign. Carol Walker of the BBC has this report from Tbilisi.
Both sides have been reinforcing their positions after yesterday's fierce fighting resulted in stalemate. For the first time, the opposition have obtained some heavy artillery, including two howitzer field guns, as well as mortars and rockets. More armored cars have been maneuvering around the opposition headquarters, itself the target of an unsuccessful attack by troops loyal to President Gamzukurdia yesterday. The opposition appear to be preparing for a fresh offensive. Their leader, Tengiz Kitovani, said the bloodshed must not be allowed to continue indefinitely. According to Ministry of Health officials, 8 people died and more than 50 were wounded yesterday, though they themselves admit the real toll is almost certainly higher. A number of buildings around the parliament were still smouldering today. During a brief lull in the fighting, many civilians who've been trapped in their homes for several days packed up their belongings and left. One woman said she could not believe what was happening. Georgians fighting Georgians. Tonight there have been more outbursts of heavy machine gun and cannon fire along Rustaveli Avenue, the main street with the parliament at one end and the opposition headquarters at the other. While the opposition were preparing their new weapons, President Gamzukurdia was reported to have called in more tanks. It will not be easy to penetrate his stronghold in the parliament with a bunker built to withstand a nuclear attack.
The BBC's Carol Walker reporting from Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia.
Paul Goebel is sanguine about events in what used to be the Soviet Union. He was the State Department's expert on Soviet minorities until last week when he left government for a Washington think tank. Paul Goebel says most of the former Soviet republics are doing very well so far. He does not consider this week's meeting in Minsk, where leaders of 11 republics failed to agree on a common currency and a single army, a failure.
I think that's just totally backwards. First off, these are countries. There are 11 different countries. The Commonwealth is not a new state. You're not citizens of a new state. And these 11 countries, which have a long history of hostility one to another, hostilities that were suppressed only by the use of force from the Central Soviet government, have to reach agreements. We would be shocked if the Arabs and the Israelis sat down in one day and agreed to everything. Why are we surprised that 11 different countries can't reach agreement on everything in one 8-hour session? That's the amazing thing, that they agreed on anything, not that they agreed on so little.
There's one interpretation of events right now in the former Soviet Union that you would steer us away from. What about the warnings that we hear from former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev or his former foreign minister Eduard Shevardnadze? Now, this is a very dangerous situation, the end of central control over, say, the nuclear arsenal of the country they used to govern.
Well, given the possibilities, there's always a chance of great danger. On the other hand, a lot of the scare headlines, scare tactics that have been used are political devices to achieve particular ends. There are some real problems, but the problems are not where people are looking. Just because you have nuclear weapons on your territory does not make you a nuclear power. Otherwise, South Korea or West Germany would at one point have been nuclear powers. Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus are not nuclear powers, not even right now. The central control of the strategic arsenal is as it was. It is now in Russian hands rather than in Soviet hands, but it is still very centralized, and I feel very confident in the strategic area. The tactical nuclear weapons are somewhat more difficult to control. They're more numerous. But again, safeguards are such, and the fear of nuclear materials in the three republics that happen to have the most of weapons on their territories, namely Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, all of whom have had very bad experiences with the nuclear age. Chernobyl in the case of Ukraine and Belarus, the Semipalatinsk nuclear testing range in Kazakhstan. They want those weapons off, and they want to be nuclear free.
You say these happen to be about the greenest groups of peoples who might inherit nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. I think God is on our side. The fact that these should be the three republics that nuclear weapons happen to be on in big time ways.
Let me try out another frightening view of the future on you for a moment, and that is that, well, at this point there may not be all that much of threat of nuclear weapons, but when Russian troops pulled out of Central Europe, the troops sold everything in sight. They were broke. And if this country goes broke, or the other republics go broke, they'll sell what they can, including their expertise, and there may be countries like Iran that will be interested in buying.
I'm very concerned about a leakage of expertise. When Mr. Gorbachev is put on a pension in convertible currency to dollars, is about $35 a month, you can imagine that a lot of Soviet nuclear technicians and engineers are going to be looking for munificent salaries or $400 or $500 a week somewhere else. On the other hand, that leakage, there are ways to control that, and it's something that the International Atomic Energy Agency and other international bodies should be concerned about very, very much. I think, in some ways, focusing only on the question of control of strategic weapons has limited our attention to these other, and I think far more real, threats to our security.
Paul Goebel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Goebel is a senior associate for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was former special advisor for Soviet nationalities and the Baltic states at the State Department.